So yeah, this week we are moving on to Impressionism. Impressionism is sort of occurring in the 19th century, simultaneous to what's going on with the latter half of our lecture in Romanticism. But unlike Romanticism, which is very kind of led by the individual, Impressionism is very kind of driven by landscape, and it's also kind of inspired and heavily influenced by the influx of Eastern arts as well. So we'll notice a lot of continuity with last week in terms of these being a lot more peaceful in terms of the scenery, the new attention being paid to the way that things are painted, if you remember that kind of the bone method, as it was called in Eastern art. Now there's suddenly a lot of attention paid, a kind of self-awareness of how people are painting as well as just what they're painting. And then also the kind of new breakthroughs in things like colour and light and kind of the way in which artists paint as well, and the role of the artist in relationship to their art. So I've got a bit of a thing here. In terms of the lecture, we are also going to cover not just Impressionism, but I'm using Impressionism to talk about Impressionism moving into Expressionism, moving into Cubism. And this, I guess it's the last kind of art movement prior to what I would call the conceptual break. I would say that after Cubism, or maybe during Cubism, is the point at which art stops being about artistic depiction and starts being about ideas. So it's more about the idea behind the art than the art itself. And we can see that shift happening in Impressionism, such that some histories of art call Impressionism the first modern art movement. I prefer to see it as like the last in the kind of history of the fine and the decorative arts, the arts of kind of reproducing things in the world rather than just sort of demonstrating an idea. So yeah, we shall continue through these steps. So this is an Ansel Adams photograph. It is on the Glacier National Park, Montana, 1932. And this is kind of here to indicate, although I might have to scrub off a little bit of that red, because it's a bit distracting to have pink board marker all over this black and white painting. Sorry, photograph, not painting. So what the Ansel Adams was, one of the great photographers of the black and white era, and it's demonstrating that photography during the latter half of the 19th century develops to such a point that it could be considered an art form, that you had photographs of people first taken in sort of sitting in galleries in the same way, in studios, the same way that they would be painted by artists. And then the photographers start moving out and capturing street scenes and capturing landscapes and creating works of art by using the camera and photography to get a perfect replication of reality. This posed a unique challenge to artists in particular, artists who had previously made their living on a kind of basic level by creating images of the world and measuring their skill, as we often do, in terms of the amount of realism that they could capture in that depiction. So if you go back to the sort of 18th century portrait artists, the quality of the portrait artist is essentially defined by how realistic they can make stuff look. So some of those 17th century painters could get really good textures and really good feelings, and sort of using the oil paints to great effect. And then the 18th, 19th century portrait artists can just get really close likenesses, so it looks exactly like you. But once the camera has come along, that takes that whole role away from the artist, and the artist is left either kind of just ignoring it, as someone like Turner did, and pretending that it didn't exist, or with a lot of the Impressionists, responding to it and reacting to it in new and creative ways to find new roles for the artist. So a route towards this could be found in what we mentioned sort of in passing during our Romantics lecture, in the English pastoralist movement of the 19th century, the early 19th century. So this is a John Constable, John Constable's Branch Hill Pond. And you can see how it's actually got a lot in common if we flick back and forth between Ansel Adams and the John Constable. It's got mountains, it's got lighting effects, it's got all that good stuff that you want from a nice dramatic kind of scene. What Constable has done though is use the paint to smooth and to soften, to kind of take that sfumato effect, push it to the next level, where we're struggling to kind of make out any details at all. And in fact, this horse looks like it's just a series of white blobs with a red blob underneath, leaning its head down to drink from this lake, which is itself a series of sort of swirled around paints. And up in the sky, the sort of very English oppressive weather that's got, you know, some cold looking rain and a break where some vague grey sunlight is coming in and all that wind swashing around the scene. It's very much capturing the kind of, I guess, pastoral environmental effects, the sense of being there at the time and at that place. And Constable was known for this. Constable was then kind of developed upon by the painter J.M.W. Turner. Calais Pier is one of his. Turner painted landscapes, but also painted maritime art, so he did loads and loads of paintings of boats. What he learned from Constable, however, was to use the surface and the texture of the paint on the canvas to create effects. So here on Calais Pier, which is 1802, we can see that he's got some very, very traditional, realistic depictions of boats, both the mechanics of the boat and how it works and the sail and all of the different people on it, all kind of done in a very realistic manner. He's, even this tiny little face here that's about the size of your thumb, well, the end of your thumb even, the thumbprint has got like realistic details in it. So he's got loads of attention to detail everywhere in the painting, but here in the pier itself, because what we're seeing here is a scene of struggle where all these boats see that there's this big terrible storm coming that's going to wreck the boats, and they're trying to get the boats into the pier so that they can kind of tie them up and save them before the boat just gets destroyed and they fall in and drown. But in the pier itself, like in the dock, there's all this water smashing up and swooshing around, and so it's almost impossible to get all of these people on these boats in, like this boat is doing, to the side of the pier and sort of secured. And so to capture the kind of terrifying nature of this port that is simultaneously both their worst nightmare because it's full of splashing water, but also exactly where they need to be, he's used this effect where he's kind of put very, very wet paint and splattered it, smashed it directly on using his brush and hitting his brush against the surface of the canvas so that it's raised up from the canvas, and it almost kind of breaks the illusion, so that where you've got very illusionistic, realistic detail, here in the swirling miasma, you've got the paint kind of just sitting there on the canvas to give this kind of explosive effect. Turner really liked this effect. He was a very sort of disagreeable gentleman, and so the more that people kind of picked up on things like this and said, well, I think it's a very good painting, but I don't like this bit, he would always go and, you know, intentionally exaggerate the stuff that people didn't like. He was always threatened with being kicked out of the Royal Academy. So one of his paintings that did almost get him kicked out was Rain, Steam and Speed, which was one of the first like big controversial works of art after the Pre-Raphaelites would cause all sorts of kind of shock horror because they would depict sort of women and looking slightly too lascivious, or it would be kind of scenes that were too romantic. Turner was the first artist to shock with people thinking that it wasn't real art. So Rain, Steam and Speed is largely a kind of brown and vaguely blue and grey looking mess with this steam engine appearing on top of what looks to be a viaduct out of the Rain, Steam and Speed kind of image. You've got a very vague viaduct here as well that you can just about make out. He argued that this isn't in any way a kind of mess. It's not abstraction as we would think about it today. He argued that this is what it actually looks like. If you go and sit on a wet and smoggy, foggy day when it's raining and it's grey and horrible in English in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, and you sit and you watch trains come through the smoke blasting out steam, this is what it actually looks like. It doesn't look like the scenes that you know, the more idyllic painters were doing. Turner really sort of broke new ground in this sort of thing. In his later eras, he would take it even further and do pieces that were just more exploratory and for himself, which we've only really kind of discovered, but you can see how ahead of his time he was. Here he was painting more ships. This is Burning Ship from 1830, but he would use very, very loose watercolours and inks. Inspired a lot by Eastern art, so you can see that kind of creeping in. He was a big fan of the Sumei style of ink, very suggestive kind of Japanese ink style where you would use just a couple of little flourishes to create a whole landscape. And here he's creating images of ships on fire or burning or in the middle of storms, a whole series of them by using ink blots and washing them. Really sort of revolutionary, although by this point, it stopped being seen by other people. So it's inspired by this that we can then hop across to France, and the Impressionist movement is specifically a French movement, and see the first emergences of it in the work of Edouard Manet. So Manet is interesting because Manet is one of the first and earliest Impressionists, but he was already famous as a painter before he became an Impressionist. So he was a classical painter, he painted classical scenes, and then he did sort of landscape scenes, crowd scenes, and inspired by what he was seeing from these other artists who weren't yet famous, who hadn't yet had their own gallery shows, he was seeing this style inspired by Eastern art and inspired by people like Turner, where his colleagues would be doing this sort of reduced detail effect. And so Manet, in scenes like Music in the Tuileries, 1862, you can see how he's still like depicting faces in realistic manners. Where he needs to, he's got a lot of detail. He's there, we've got a gentleman with a top hat who's looking very kind of neatly done. But where you've got people in the background moving quickly, they don't have faces. Sometimes they're just a mess of kind of hodgepodge of colors. You can use his sort of quality of light to hide the face in shadow. And so you've got different levels of depth to some of the... Here's a face with a guy with a monocle who's got a lot of detail. And just one person back from him is someone who's just a couple of dots. And you can really make a lot out of this play between how much, I guess, volume and intensity and detail he's got and how much he's sparing it. On some of his other work here is In the Conservatory, 1879. We can see again this play between the faces of his characters, a lot of detail, a lot of attention to the colour of their eyes, for example, the slight blush of the cheeks. We get a real, very realistic sense of who this person is, something that a camera couldn't quite do yet because they hadn't got colour quite right for the cameras. But down here, where we've got this umbrella, it's just a kind of swoosh of colour, because why bother spending all your time getting the texture of an umbrella? If you go back to the 17th century, of course, all these sort of Dutch masters would be, of course, you have to spend all your time on the umbrella. People would be impressed by a good umbrella. Here, the importance isn't the umbrella, it's the kind of overall effect of the painting. You can see that in his face being slightly less rendered than hers as well, because we're looking at her, we're not necessarily looking at him. He's got enough to be slightly realistic, but the real focus of attention is on her face. Degas is around this time, Edgar Degas, who paints largely dancers and particularly young dance classes. And Degas is also interested in this sort of dance between the ephemeral effects of sort of using very loose brush strokes, and then the detailed effects that we can see here on this dance class, captured in some of the faces turned away from us, whereas some of the faces used towards us are not particularly rendered. And then in the mirror that we've got at the back there, we've just got very loose shapes. Now, here's another ballet rehearsal, 1873. The thing that Degas picks up on more than Manet does is the importance of light in all of this. Because if we're gonna start taking liberties with how much detail we're showing, the way to do that is to follow reality and how the human eye actually works, which is, I guess, the same thing that Turner was thinking when he was showing all that fog and steam, which is that when there's light falling on something, our eyes can pick out more details, and so they tend to do so. But the more shadow is used, the more light softens things. It tends to create flatness when things are in shadow, and it also tends to kind of dissuade the eye from focusing too much on things in shadow. And so here we can see how these big windows are letting this wall of light in, and where it's hitting people's faces, and in this case the back of their heads and her face there, and the toes even here, are picked out with lots of detail. When people are turned towards us, which is facing into shadow, we have no faces at all. It's just, well, we get a little bit of a suggestion of one there in darkness, but some have no faces at all. And it's this play of light and dark, which, and the realistic depiction, as you can see here, of shadows appearing in corners, which is really well observed. This can only be taken from life. It's not, light doesn't work exactly how you think it would. It tends to kind of shadows pile up in corners or like hang down from nearest the light source and things like that. But this all creates this realistic effect, which is also an impressionistic effect. So the first artist to consciously embrace the idea of impressionism was Renoir. Renoir is simultaneously, I guess, the one of the biggest names in Impressionism and also one of the worst artists on a technical level. So some of Renoir's paintings are kind of, he got away with a lot of stuff because he was like the big vocal mouthpiece for Impressionism. So I've picked one here that has not such strange anatomy or weird perspective, which he tends to do in a lot of his interior shots. This one, which is La Grenouillière, I'm not particularly good at my French pronunciation, from 1869. It's a group of people waiting to get onto a boat. You can see they're all kind of crowded together. We can see they've got their Sunday best on, all their finery, various different colours and lots of what look like nice frilly dresses and quite smart gentlemen's kind of jackets on. And we've got all these people sort of swimming around in the water that they're looking down on. There's a lot of kind of big compositional gestures, so we know where everything is in relationship to each other. And there's a huge amount of lighting effects, but the focus is upon the overall impression of the scene. And so this is where the idea of impression comes from, of impressionism, which is what Renoir was. The way he described it was that, you know, the photograph can now capture the scene objectively. What we are trying to do is capture our impression of the scene to give a sense of what has struck us, not necessarily what we've objectively seen, but the thing that has struck us with its impression. And so by flattening out here and overemphasizing, I guess, the shadow, the light, the flickering of the movement of the water, the sun bouncing off it, the sort of speckled light, which is that nice summer light that you get sort of when you're near trees and by water. It's a very kind of romantic and light. It's light enjoyed for its own sake. It's that attitude that we get with, I guess, the Song Dynasty painters, where it's like in the midst of chaos, where you can have a nice image we can turn to and enjoy. That little not particularly well-rendered dog lying down is quite picturesque. And so his reasoning behind this is that he's capturing the instant. One of the reasons that you can kind of do this is as we can see here in a Singer Sargent's painting of Monet, is also to do with the way in which Impressionists painted and the kind of places they painted. So the Impressionists, unlike all artists previous to them, were not studio painters. So if you'd been to art school in France in the 19th century, or any time since the Renaissance, the artists did their job in a studio. They brought things into the studio, you constructed backgrounds if you wanted to paint things outside, because you could control all the effects in the studio. You could make the light work the way you wanted it to, you could focus for a long amount of time on particular details, you could get your models to sort of stand the way you want, and you could have them sort of sit there for an hour, then take a break, then come back, and you could just control everything in a studio. The Impressionists moved out into the countryside. They took their easels, they took their palettes, their palette knives, their all of their equipment out, and they painted what was called in plein air, in the open air. This has a number of effects. The first is that they have to work quickly, and so it's another justification for working with loose brushstrokes, because if you've got a sudden burst of sort of beautiful light hitting a beautiful scene, you want to get it painted then when you can see it and not spend 20 minutes making a bush look really nice, by which time the sun has moved out of the way and you can't see it anymore. It also meant that they were particularly enamored of the perfect moment. So they worked very quickly, very fast, and they often selected times like the golden hour, the first light of morning, the last light of the evening. And they picked those times because they don't last very long. They're sort of 20 minutes to half an hour, depending on the time of year, of very nice orange warm light. And they would go out and they would seek to capture that very quickly. And because they're sat there staring at it, it also emphasizes the role of the eye and the role of the kind of artist as an instant capture of a mood, of a moment. That impression, that word assumes that they're capturing what they feel at the same time as what they kind of see of a scene, is all about that. So Camille Pissarro is one of my favorite impressionists. He's slightly more realistic than most of the impressionists, but you can see in his painting the effect that this painting in plein air has on the overall kind of style. You can see that rather than an imagined landscape, which is what, for example, someone like John Constable would do. John Constable would go out and he would make a little pencil sketch of the landscape. He would take it back and he would work for a couple of weeks to build that up in his studio, how he thinks it should be according to the rules of art. Pissarro would do a scene like this in front of the scene itself. And so, for example, in Pissarro, it's the first time in art where we start to get the realization that shadows have color, that they aren't just grayer versions of the actual color, but they have a relationship to the things around them there because they are refracted light. You're seeing light coming off a number of sources and then hitting you, rather than, you know, just adding a bit of gray to the pre-existing color to paint in the shadow. You have to look objectively at the shadow and paint the color that it is. You also see the kind of flatness of the sky. He's not put any kind of like romantic fluffy little clouds in. The trees are all quite gnarled but very realistic looking, and we he's taken some liberties with the architecture because you don't want to spend too long with it, but he's got a very real sense of, by capturing the color correctly, you can capture a lot of depth and detail to it. Here's Jallet Hill Pontoise from 1867. And you can see he also embraces slightly clumsy, slightly kind of off-kilter compositions as well. So you'd imagine that if you were painting this in a studio, you would probably, you might like all this village that we're looking down on. It's very, you know, romantic. We've got some nice clouds, we've got a nice hill in the background, but we've got this big clump of green here that you would probably want to just get rid of and, you know, fill it in. The way that a lot of the romantic landscape artists painted was they would capture little bits of a scene from different angles and bring it together in the studio to make a more perfect scene. Here he's kind of embracing the slightly intrusive bush that then meets this row of poplars here that are slightly too close to this, which are slightly too close to that, such that all this is creating a little bit of visual noise on that side of the canvas. And also here we have this woman with her friend coming around the corner here and looking and staring straight at us, and it's a little moment of revelation in the midst of this scene where we think we're looking at a landscape, but then down in this corner we have a woman who's sort of catching our eye, and it's like, oh, maybe this is what the scene's about. It's a little bit of drama, it's ambiguous, but it's also, again, it's realistic. This is how it actually looked, because you would never really put her underneath this tree beside this bush with her friend half covered up. You would move them out, give them some, you know, negative space. And here in Le Grand Noyer and Hermitage, butchering these ones, this one's from 1875, not 1975, as I wrote down on my notes down there. You can see again this impact of light and shadow, and how shadows have colour and light's colour is impacted by everything around it. And so this has got really, really loose. It's a very, very quick one, but you can tell that his emphasis is entirely upon the light and the differences of the cold foreground where there's lots of shadow and the sort of very spattered light at the back here. You'd struggle to even say what this is depicting. Is it buildings? Is it, you know, it looks like it might be a bit of a tree or a bit of kind of foliage, but as you can tell from the light coming off here, it's to do with light and shadow, and it really captures that sense of, it sort of feels like one of those days where the sun's gone in a little bit too early and it's still bright. You've got that kind of wintry blue sky, and you've got people walking to and from things, what look like chickens or little dogs, I can't quite tell. But the sun's already gone in a bit too early and we're enjoying the last of the light. Alfred Sisley was the only English impressionist who went over to Paris, and he was particularly interested in painting water effects and sky effects. So here's his piece, the St. Martin Canal, from 1817. You can see how these ephemeral effects, the movement of water and sky, become a constant kind of point of interest for impressionists. And Berthe Marisot, who was the most famous of the women impressionists, of which there are quite a few, Jour d'été, Summer's Day, 1879. She really embraced this idea of simplification and pushed it so far that it arguably becomes kind of conceptual. It becomes more abstract, such that in the backgrounds here we've got such a weight of movement and sort of it becomes quite flat. The light, the movement, the reflections, the refractions. Morisot's canvases are quite small, so when you do see her paintings, they look to be a lot kind of more rushed than some of the bigger ones, but this tends to be because she's working on smaller canvases, because she could sell more of them more cheaply. And so you can see at the corners of the canvas here, she's not even put any paint on it, just kind of get the raw canvas effect. But it really captures a moment, and she's got a good eye for putting people in these scenes, and it kind of gives you a sense of looking at the figure and what they're feeling, gives you something to kind of read through. Now, behind all this artistic shift is also a series of scientific shifts. So this is the Sennelier, it's a photograph, ironically, of Sennelier's art shop. Because behind all of this, there's a whole bunch of scientific breakthroughs going on in the realm of optics and in the realm of sort of pigment development, kind of making paint and understanding how the eye works. It's all shifting and changing. It's the 19th century. It's kind of industrial revolution, the series of breakthrough after breakthrough after breakthrough in science. So the relevant for us is the breakthroughs, particularly in art theory and optic theory. In 1861, Michel Eugène Chevreul creates the kind of the foundational groundwork study of optics, which we still use today in our color theory. So color theory comes from Chevreul's theories of the eye. He created the term complementary colors, for example, which was a scientific understanding of how all of the different parts of color come together to form the color wheel, and then the different things that we've got, like tone and hue and color and things like that. At the same time that he's doing that in the kind of realm of science and understanding, we have the chemist Gustave Sennelier, who essentially becomes a specialist in working with paints and pigments and moves his abstract chemistry into the commercial realm and starts to own the most famous paint shop in all of Paris. Sennelier's paints were the only ones that Impressionists would work with, because he could not just give you a colour, but he could give you a whole range of things with it. So he essentially broke the understanding of colour into four parts, which was hue, chroma, saturation, and value. Later on, he added a few more. Nowadays, we've got like between 7 and 10 different ways to understand color, depends on how you look it up. And some of the words shift and change depending upon whether you're talking about physical paints, you know, ground up bits of rock and you know, bugs and things, which they were using then, or whether it's modern digital color. But ultimately, Sennelier and the artists that he worked with saw color as comprising of hue, which is what we just call colour. So hue is like, is it red, is it blue, is it purple? Chroma, which is the purity of a colour. So a high chroma has no added black or grey or white. It's just the pure sort of, they didn't add anything else into it. Whereas you could have low chroma, which would soften things and make them, you know, if you wanted it to have a bit of grey in to make it more useful for a kind of misty scene. Saturation, which we're familiar with because nowadays all of our phones have that on the camera, you can change the saturation. It's essentially how strong or weak a colour is. And then value, which is how light or dark the colour is, which again is nowadays just a slider. But back then it involved a lot of science in order to affect the value of something without affecting its chroma, for example. So how do you kind of keep a super high chroma colour but make it dark without adding, because the natural thing would be to add a bunch of black to it because that will make it darker. But Sennelier had different techniques which would allow him to give you a dark yellow without adding any black, so it still punches through. The last of these, value, is the most important for the Impressionists. They called it luminance, and they had a kind of almost religious sort of iconic respect for luminance. Luminance became the defining term. When you became an Impressionist, you had to go to lectures. They gave each other lectures and got scientists to give lectures. Sennelier gave lectures about the theory of luminance. Luminance is how value is working in the scene. So Monet, who I've held back on because he's my favorite of the Impressionists, after Pissarro, depends on the day. But yeah, Monet is one of the more advanced. Monet's work is incredibly scientifically astute, as well as being sort of great artistically. Monet was working right at the cutting edge of science. He was having discussions and like going to lectures and doing lectures himself with people like Sennelier, with the theorists, you know, the top theorists and scientists of sight and colour at the time. And some of his works like this, which is the most famous, this one's called Impression Sunrise, which is another route from which we get this label Impressionism. Some people say Renoir created it, some people say it's named after Impression Sunrise, which is he went out to the port at sunrise, and captured this image, which has got a beautiful amount of contrast between the reds and the blues, and yet it has this totally kind of faded out look to it. And so Monet, what he's doing here really is a scientific experiment, because what he's doing is he's playing with luminance, this idea of value. So if you take this image and you put it through a monochrome filter, you'll notice that the sun entirely disappears. And this, in the foreground, this boat becomes a lot darker than it looks on the original image. The reason for this is that he's trying to work out, through capturing his impression of the actual light and this mistiness, how can he use luminance contrasted with hue in order to play with contrasts and uncontrasts. So that sun, because it has the same, the red and the blue have the same luminance, it disappears under monochrome, but it punches through purely based on its hue and saturation level. So a super saturated bit of red there next to a very unsaturated bit of blue, and we get this dramatic stark effect, and he's playing with that all the way across, and it gives us this sense which is kind of incredibly realistic whilst breaking every rule in the traditional kind of way of painting. Sense of the light and the environmental effects all kind of sitting in front of us. The way that when you look out at a scene that you can barely glimpse anything that's going on, but you kind of see the basic shapes and you see the movement of the color in it, and you can just about make out what's happening. He's really captured that sunrise scene. He was also very scientific in the subjects that he painted. So Monet pretty much paints the same thing over and over and over again. His haystacks were, all of them kind of have their own artistic sort of beauty and grace, and the sense of like, you could take all sorts of, you know, meaning out of them. It's pastoral, it's harking back to a simpler time when everyone worked the land. It's got some nice visual effects. It captures the sense of the tone and the day. But also, he would always return to these two haystacks, and he would paint them over and over and over again. So this is the early morning painting that he did. This is haystacks in the evening. Here's the haystacks in the bright sunlight. And here is them at the end of summer. So we've got four different paintings of two haystacks, all of which, well, each of them using their own techniques, creating their own senses of volume and shape and space, and all of them capturing the light. So these ones in particular are quite stark differences. Monet used to say that he didn't paint things, he didn't paint objects, he painted the envelope of light that surrounded them, which is quite pretentious, but it's a very Monet thing to say. Later in his life as well, because he did this with haystacks over and over and over, and he did it again with a cathedral near where he lived over and over. And as he became successful and rich, he decided that he didn't even have to leave his home, and he made himself a garden. So this is Monet's garden, which you can visit today, in which he had calculated everything to make sure that it gave him as many different points to paint from as possible to have a series of original scenes. So he has this Japanese bridge, which he was very proud of. And he's got lots of kind of, big flourishes of different colored trees and bushes, and then all of his famous water lilies. So here's his water lilies and Japanese bridge from 1899. He would basically just get out of bed, have his easel and paint set up for him by his kind of helper, who lived with him, and this helper just had to be ready. So you go, I think tomorrow we'll wake up at 4 and capture the 4 a.m. light. And so the helper would get up at 3, set it all up, get him some breakfast, and he'd get out of bed, eat his breakfast, do half an hour's painting, straight back to bed. And he would capture the same scenes over and over and over, looking for the ideal light form, looking for the kind of that perfect impression of a scene. And then as he gets older as well, he starts to move away even from the impression of a scene and towards the kind of the raw quality of the light, that pure kind of envelope of light, such that in his water lilies, he's kind of broken away entirely from scenes that are recognizably physical, even though this is still something that he can see by looking into the waters of his pond. He's kind of avoided any depth. He's not got any perspective. It's just like, if it was a camera, it'd be pointed straight at the water lilies with these overhanging tree vines, like the willow vines, just kind of getting slightly in the way. And it's pure color, pure light, pure effect without any content. Monet is pretty much the kind of pinnacle of the Impressionists. You have some artists that come around after the Impressionists who are known as the Post-Impressionists. Schurer is one of the more famous of these. He's done the famous painting A Sunday Afternoon in the Island of La Grangeatte. Schurer's interesting because he creates pontillism, which, as you probably know, is like where you do lots and lots of dots, all of this of different colours, and when you stand back this on these huge, because he does huge canvases, they unify into these things. But it's, I figure it's kind of a dead end with Schurer, because he's doing this to show off how well he understands colour, that he can use just like primary colour dots and create green and yellow and these effects. But ultimately, whereas Impressionism has this huge capacity to grow and to change and to give you lots of different new approaches, Post-Impressionism tends to be defined by something that's exciting and new for one painting, and then they do the same thing again, and the same thing again, and after about four paintings, people are bored with them. So Schurer has bought himself a place in art history with his pointillism, but after you've seen this painting, and sometimes the painting on the other correspond, you know, like opposite side of the river, you've pretty much seen all of Schurer, and you can kind of move on from him. Cézanne is a more interesting post-impressionist. There's a few others like Gauguin and people like this, but Cézanne is interesting because he kind of is a natural stepping point between Impressionism and what comes next, which is Expressionism. Because Cézanne, you can see he's doing a lot of that kind of very rough work, concentrating on light, on shade, on shadow. But Cézanne also brings to his paintings his own interpretation of the space. So we've got increasing amounts of kind of line work here. We've got very dark black uses of squared off, I guess you would call it like outline work. Line work essentially has come back in. There's no line work in most of the Impressionists. And here down in, we've got a very unrealistic sense of almost cubes, very, you know, columns falling into the water, which is not a very realistic way of depicting that reflection of a house, but it does give a very definite sense of what the artist saw. And so Cézanne essentially is the defining line between this idea of impressionism, which is that no longer are we catching the objective image of a scene, we're catching our impression of the scene, and expressionism, which is when you capture the artist's emotions at the time of painting. So here's an expressionist piece. You can see how it's very similar. This is a very early Kandinsky. Kandinsky's most famous for his later kind of abstract work, but he began as one of the leading expressionists. This is Aktika, I think, from 1901. The expressionists were German rather than, largely German, whereas the impressionists were largely French. And they had a more, I guess, interior notion of what painting was for. Whereas the impressionists were just finding a new way to capture scenes, the expressionists wanted you to feel the artist's feelings whilst they were looking at the scene. So here you can see a lot of blur, a lot of kind of inattention to detail. The focus on lighting disappears with expressionism and is replaced by a more aggressive use of colour, of lights and darks, of using things to kind of rough paintwork to show the feeling and the emotion of the painter as he splats on and drags that paint around. Van Gogh as well did a lot of this kind of style, although not known for it in his life. He was kind of doing the same thing that the expressionists were doing in Germany, just a lot less successfully in the south of France. And so you can see with paintings like Sower with Setting Sun, 1888, that the sun is gigantic, bigger than it would ever be, and it's smushed on that paint with an aggression that shows the importance of it to the artist. The sower is very roughly done as well. He's seemingly positioned beneath the sun as a suggestion, a hint towards like Apollo and those ancient Egyptian kind of uses of the sun as a halo. And then we've got this very cold blue of the fields, which is, I don't think there's any lighting conditions that will give you that blue. It's such a bright blue. But it's contrasted with a bright green sky and pink clouds, which all together works in a kind of unified way. A lot like the early Simpsons, if you've ever seen some of their colour palettes, they have this kind of purple sky effect. And it works really nicely all together. And there's a real sort of passion in the paintwork, that bone method, as the Chinese artists would describe it, seeing the feeling of the person painting in the painting itself is there, particularly with the Wheatfield with Crows from 1890, which is the last painting that he did he essentially walked off from this canvas and then shot himself. And so that means a lot gets read into this, as you can imagine. As with most of Van Gogh's, you kind of read his personality, his soul into his paintings, which is pure expressionism. That's impressionism isn't interested in the artist's personal feelings. It's more their interpretation of the scene, whereas the scene itself, it doesn't even matter where this is. I don't think you'd get a huge amount from going and seeing the actual cornfield that Van Gogh painted. It's all just about finding in here the feelings of the artist, this rough, aggressive paintwork style. You can see the smudges almost look like he's dragged his fingers across the canvas. There's a kind of staccato, machine gun, bullet-riddled style of lots of splat, 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 aggressive pushing the paint onto the canvas. And these very, very simple little kind of floating M, Homer Simpson hairdo style, to go back to the Simpsons, birds that are flying off. They've been scared by something, and what is it? And like, the suggestion is, if you read it through the artist, that, well, it's because he's just about to go off and shoot himself, and so it's them all getting scared away by the shot. So it's like it's like a bit of autobiography rather than a depiction of a cornfield. Munch is one of these, one of the more famous of the expressionists. This one, Anxiety, in 1894. Munch, you'll probably know his work from The Scream. I find that The Scream, like The Last Supper, is one of these paintings that's almost impossible to see properly because you've seen it 18 billion times, reproduced over and over and over again, and you just kind of know it so well and so much that you can't look at it with fresh eyes. So I think looking at some of his other paintings, that he does quite a few from this look. He's looking down at his hometown, but with different studies. You can appreciate a bit more Munch's kind of, some of the revolutionary kind of things he's doing. He was a Norwegian, but he moved to Germany to because the Expressionists really liked his work. You can see how he's no longer focusing on a realistic picture of space or of people or anatomy, and instead he's using like little tiny dot eyes for these people to give you the sense that they're very sort of insect-like. You read no personality out of them, they're just kind of looking out at you. And you, I guess the anxiety of the title is him as an artist being anxious with all of these faces, some of them at the back looking a bit horrific, like Elephant Man kind of masks staring at you, all these people staring at him whilst in the background there's ships about to set sail with almost blood red water in the lagoon, and the sky is this miasma of blood and kind of intense colours. It's a very psychedelic effect. He has a lot of these pieces, all expressing his inner turmoil rather than the landscape itself. Franz Marc is another expressionist, one of my favourites because he just does lots of animals, which I think is kind of fun. This one, The Yellow Cow from 1913, is one of his happier ones. You can see he's just in a big happy cow. It's got this face like mooing with happy blissed out eyes. It's got nice sort of, the colours of the cow are very kind of, you've got blue, you've got yellow. It's primary colours. Around it in the landscape, the colours get a lot less primary. They start getting a bit more confused, a bit more kind of, you've got maroons, you've got purples, you've got kind of turquoisey blues, and there's a kind of twisted, it's sort of not quite rightness to the landscape, so that we get this feeling of the artist's inner joy, but also a certain sort of threatening, unsettling nature to the world. It's not like a child's painting, it's not something that you could put in a kid's book. It's slightly too menacing for that, but it also has a lot of childlike joy underneath these sort of imposing mountains. He tended to paint animals because he considered them to be purer, whereas human beings are kind of, I guess, weighed down by our intelligence. Animals have a kind of natural response, and he liked that. His most famous painting, The Fate of the Animals from 1913, uses this for kind of pathos effect, where the fact that the animals are innocent, they are the ultimate kind of victims because they're totally innocent and can't be, this is 1913, so the war is coming in about 6 months' time, and he could tell the war was coming. And so by depicting animals dying in the war, being killed in the First World War by very, what looks like aggressive, like blood splatters, machine gun kind of fire, and all this sort of brown death mechanisms and kind of rot, decay, aggressive kind of terrified looks from these animals that are almost becoming machine-like themselves. It captures this pure innocence being wiped away, washed away in this tidal wave of fire and blood and death. And so what he saw was coming with the First World War, which he believed was going to be even worse than it actually was. Interestingly, on this piece, it's been set on fire, which is how it's created this effect. I reckon he probably did it using a bit of lighter fuel and setting it on fire. But there's been this myth that's arisen that the painting got lost and then got set on fire in the war and rescued, and that it was a fire in the war that destroyed the painting. He never actually said either way, so we don't know, but I figure it's an intentional effect. Either way, it really helps the painting, I think. So with expressionism, which is expressing the inner turmoil of the artist, it's not far to then jump over into the break with realistic depiction in the form of cubism, or I guess the last tentative hangings on to reality before we enter the conceptual. So this is a Braque painting, Still Life, Le Jour, 1919, whereas Impressionism is largely French and the Expressionists are largely German, the centre for cubism was tended to be Spain, northern Spain, Barcelona, the republican areas of Spain. They were initially known as Le Fauve, the wild beasts. It was the French, as you can imagine, who disapproved of them. And this was because they integrate a lot of art from North Africa and a lot of ancient art that was just being discovered. They take art from kind of what at the time was called primitive art, art from kind of lesser developed cultures, and they integrate it into their own style, which then has its own kind of ambiguous effect. So with Braque, you can see how there's a guitar that's done in a kind of very flat style. Here you've got a kind of pointed effect, which looks like something he's taken from African art. And the final ingredient for it was this multi-perspectivalism. It was this idea that, whereas I guess Impressionism is all about the personal sight, Expressionism is all about the personal feeling, Cubists hope to find numerous different perspectives and attach them together. So here we can see that this bit is the front of the table faced directly from someone at its level. But we're also looking at the table from above. This is a knife viewed from the top, whereas this is a joke viewed from the side. This, you know, all of the different pieces are stuck together from different perspectives, all viewing the same thing from different ways. And that explains why it becomes more cubic and why it becomes kind of, simultaneously, it's got so many perspectives, it becomes flat. We can see this equally with like Picasso stuff, the Demoiselles d'Avignon in 1907, where it's got that kind of, from African art, we have a much more lively kind of sense of movement, of energy. You can see that the faces are clearly influenced by African masks, almost Easter Island head looking faces. And also the shapes, the kind of broken and fragmentedness of it, is because it was a series of life studies done from a series of different angles combined together onto one piece. We can just see that again in The Three Musicians, where we've got it simplified again and simplified over and over. The thing with Picasso is he would paint 2 to 3 paintings a day. So if you ever go to a Picasso exhibition, you will find some stinkers in there. And that's just kind of par for the course because he painted so many paintings. Other painters have done that, like Francis Bacon, but Francis Bacon always destroyed everything he didn't like. Picasso tended to just let it out there in the world, and like some of his masterpieces would go for billions now. In fact, some of the lesser, you know, not quite so good works go for billions as well, because it's a Picasso. But it depends which piece you see. So this one's got a heavy kind of influence of African art and this multi-perspectival approach. But you can also see that it's kind of broken almost entirely at this point from that Impressionist moment of going out into the world and looking at things. It's become more conceptual, it's moved back into the studio. When we have pieces like Guernica, which is a political statement as much as a work of art, it was painted after the bombing of Guernica by fascist forces during the Republican city of Guernica was bombed by the fascists, and lots of innocent people died. It was the first act of total war, which would go on to define the Second World War, with, you know, bombs being dropped on cities like the Blitz, you know, Dresden, Coventry, both entirely wiped off the face of the map. This is the first kind of bombing of that type. And so here we've got a series of women, children, and animals, and they're all screaming and dying in horror because of the bombing of the city by the fascists. And so partly this is using all the techniques of cubism, numerous perspectives, things like, you can see the horns of the bull are not on the top of its head, it's kind of a different perspective. It's the two eyes on different sides of the head looking at you from the same side of the head is a very kind of multi-perspectival effect. Here you can see inside the horse's mouth, at the same time you can see the side of its mouth. He's also added symbolism, so we've got kind of the, where are we? Yeah, we've got the eye looking down in the form of the light bulb. We've got this head, kind of ghostly head looking in, holding a candle, almost like it's kind of witnessing the scene. Kind of on observer, international observer looking in horrified. And this tied into Picasso's communism, in that he was a Marxist and believed that kind of history moved through a series of struggles, like class struggles, struggles between historical forces. And so using lots of different perspectives fitted in with his Marxist view of the world, which is that the world emerges from a series of perspectives all coming in, clashing together, and eventually a new world emerging out of the clashing together of the old world. At which point we are reaching modern art, which is where the idea comes first and the art comes after. At least that's how I would tend to define that break. So by the end of Cubism, Guernica is more about the ideas than it is about the painting itself. You can look at the painting and think it's quite nice, but it's only after someone's explained to you what Guernica was, when it was painted, why it was painted, in this case, like who the goodies and the baddies are, who you should feel sorry for, what the symbolism means, then you go, oh, this is a great work of art, now you've explained it. That wouldn't happen with an impressionist piece. So I figure that's a good place to leave us, just here on the edge of modern art and modernism, where next week we shall jump away from nice landscapes towards kind of all sorts of weird conceptual stuff. So we'll end it there.